Good evening, everyone. I'm Abby Strew, the Chair of Young Americans for Freedom at the University of Wisconsin. On behalf of Wisconsin YAF, I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight. So you can keep up with most of us, with us on most social media platforms under the handle of @WisconsinYAF. I would also like to thank everyone who will be tuning into this from Young America's Foundation's YouTube channel. So Young Americans for Freedom is a national affiliation of conservative high school and college chapters that are on hundreds of campuses across the United States. YAF was founded in the early 1960s by William F. Buckley, a prominent leader in the conservative movement, as well as the founder of the National Review. We in YAF advocate for values such as limited government, constitutional rights, traditional values, a strong national defense, and free enterprise through activism. If any of that interests you, please find me or anybody on our e-board after the event, and we can hook you up with how to get involved. So before I welcome our speaker, I'd like to take the time to thank a few people. First of all, I would like to thank the Herbold family for their helping us put on this lecture. I cannot express enough gratitude for all the Herbolds have done to help promote conservatism, especially with their help with this lecture. Thank you so much for your support of college students. So I would also like to thank our parent organization, Young Americas Foundation. Your support on campus through your programs has really helped us take what was a tiny chapter and help us grow and make an impact over the 3 years of our existence. So thank you also to the Center for the Study of Liberal Democracy, who has supported our chapter numerous times in the past. And with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker. Dr. Christina Hoff-Summers is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where she studies the politics of gender and feminism. Before joining AEI, she was a professor of philosophy at Clark University. Her articles have appeared in publications such as the Journal of Philosophy, the New England Journal of Medicine, the New York Times, and the Atlantic. Summers is the editor of Vice and Virtue in Everyday Life, a textbook on moral philosophy. Her books include Who Stole Feminism?, The War Against Boys, the latter being a New York Times bestseller. She is the co-author of One Nation Under Therapy. Her video blog, The Factual Feminist, has attracted millions of views, and she co-hosts a new podcast, The Femsplainers. You can follow her at CH Summers on Twitter. And with that, I am pleased to introduce you, Christina Hoff-Summers.
I'm sorry, I have to request that there be no clapping. As you may know that our progressive friends on the left have pointed out that it's triggering, and it can cause fainting spells and, I don't know, hyperventilation. So the tradition that I favor is simply to click your hands if you like something I said. And if you really like what I'm about to say, you can award me with feminist jazz hands. But clapping is can induce panic. Oh, okay. So now that we have that set of rules established, it's wonderful to be here in Madison. I mean, I'm used to such quiet and calm audiences. When I was at UMass Amherst, every time I opened my mouth, this young woman was screaming and swearing. And last year, I was at Lewis and Clark, a law school, not even undergraduates. Law students, and these protesters at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon, stormed the stage, prevented me from speaking, called me a known fascist, which was confusing. I'm sort of a former flower child, Vietnam War protester, registered Democrat, you know, not happy with that, but still, there I am. But I'm called a fascist. The ringleader was this blonde woman in a jacket that had the word stay woke on the back. But what really got me is that she hadn't memorized her chants. So they were chanting, go home fascist, or the wage gap is real. And she kept having to look down at her phone because she didn't know her chants. Now, to any protesters in the room, if you're going to try to shut down a speaker, please have the decency to memorize your chants. Well, this evening, my topic is how to make feminism great again. And some of you may be thinking, feminism's perfectly fine, thank you very much. We don't need your suggestions on how to improve it. Others are probably wondering, like, why would you want to improve something that's so outmoded and annoying? That's like trying to improve rotary phones. Let it go. Wait a minute, do you know what rotary phones are? Okay. Well, I'm not going to let feminism go, because the liberation of women is one of the great achievements of Western civilization. Women organized, fought for, and won equality before the law. Feminism is one of the great chapters in the history of the human struggle for freedom. And there's still work to do. In the US, women struggle balancing home life and work life. That violence against women has diminished, but it continues to exact a horrible toll. Most of all, there are many women across the world whose quest for freedom has just begun. And I go to international women's conferences and meet, you know, the Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony of her generation. I saw a woman speak at a New York conference who is called the Rosa Parks of Saudi Arabia. And she just got in her car one day and went, it's against the law for women to drive, but she got in her car and went on a joyride and put it on YouTube. And she keeps doing it, and they, you know, it's become a cause celebrity. And these women ask for our help. They come to the United States and they just wonder, like, where are the college students? Who's help? They can't find them. So across the globe, women struggling for their basic liberties. And just a few months ago, there was this young woman named Rahaf Al-Kunan. She's 18 years old. She's from Saudi Arabia. And she's just a free spirit. She does not fit into that society. And she cut her hair very short, and that infuriated her brother. Imagine having this brother, who's like nightmare brother, who has rights over her. And, you know, she was beaten, and it was a nightmare. And it's a nightmare within a nightmare, because in her country, women can't travel without permission of a male guardian. And anyway, she couldn't take it, and she arranged to escape. And she was in the Bangkok airport and on her way to Australia, and she was apprehended by authorities. They alerted the Saudi authorities. The Saudi authorities wanted her back, and she was kept in a hotel room until her brother and father could arrive and take her back. She was thinking maybe she should commit suicide, but then she decided instead, picked up her iPhone and went on Twitter and asked the world for help. It went viral. It immediately got to human rights groups in Thailand, who went into action, and she is now been given asylum in Canada. She's a free woman in the country of Canada. So who needs feminism? Rahaf Al-Kunan needs feminism. The world does. But feminism needs to be rescued from its troubled state. And I do mean trouble. For one thing, if you ask, pollsters ask, a cross-section of Americans, do you consider yourself to be a feminist? Most people say no. You can, like a U.gov poll, they ask people, do you consider yourself a feminist? And you can get about 30%. 70%, for whatever reason, resist the designation. Now, some will say, well, that's all Americans. They, you know, they're old people involved in that poll. What if you look at, you know, millennials? If you look at millennials, you can break it down. It's the same. It's about 30% of millennials identify. And this is very frustrating to many feminists. They say, wait a minute. If you poll people and say, do you believe in equal rights for women? Do you believe that women should have the same opportunities? Almost everyone says yes. And that's very frustrating to feminists, because they think, if you believe in equal rights for women, why don't you say you're a feminist? Well, pollsters ask that question. And the two top answers that people give is that feminism is too extreme, and today's feminism doesn't represent the women's movement at its best. Well, I think that's exactly right. I do agree with that. If I had been asked on that poll, well, I don't know if I would say I was a feminist as it's defined today, but I strongly believe in old-fashioned classical equality feminism, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So if the thing is that if we had a powerful, organized women's movement. It could be a force for good. There's, you know, something's amiss. And in the time that I have with you, I'm going to make some suggestions on how things could be better. But first, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to say a word about how things have gone badly wrong. Example number one. Professor Susanna DeNutto-Walters is a professor of sociology, and she directs a program called Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Northeastern University. She's also the editor of the leading journal in women's studies called Signs. It calls itself the leading international journal in women's studies at the forefront of new directions in feminist scholarship. So this is not a marginal person. Well, last June, Professor Walters wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" And her view is that we can and should. She goes through a whole litany of male malfeasance and malevolence, destruction, thousands of years, you know, women have been put upon by men. Well, she's not going to take it anymore. She blames the entire gender, of the male gender, and she says, we have every right to hate you. However, there's a path to redemption, according to Professor Walters. If you're a man and you want her to stop hating you, she said that you can give the reins of power over to women. Step back, lean back. Don't take any position of power. Don't run for office. Don't do anything. Just keep quiet and don't be in charge of anything. Step away from power. It's long past time that you should play, she says, for team feminism. Now, a few months later, the Washington Post published yet another op-ed by another angry academic. Professor Victoria Bissell Brown from Grinnell describes berating her husband at the top of her lungs for 30 minutes. She writes about this. She's proud of it. She says, he's a good man, but she insists that all men are implicated in the crimes of patriarchy. And then she says, I hate all men and wish all men were dead. She says that's what she shrieked at this poor, cowering, frightened husband. Just a few observations. Hating half the human race is crazy. It's a basic tenet of civilization that you don't blame an entire group for the crimes of a few. And just as racial profiling is wrong, so is gender profiling. So these two feminist professors, they are not the norm, but they are representatives of what I would call toxic feminism. And this style of feminism is showing up increasingly in journalism, certainly in social media, and it is very much on the college campus. All right, I'm going on to a second example of feminism gone astray. During a 2018 interview with ABC News, the actor Matt Damon expressed total support for the Me Too movement, total support for the anti-harassment campaign. But he mentioned that he did have some worries that people were being punished without, you know, there was no presumption of innocence, and some people were being punished too much for relatively minor offenses. He said, we have to make distinctions and punish people in proportion to their misdeeds. There's a difference, he said, between, you know, an Al Franken and a Harvey Weinstein. Minor transgressions, according to Damon, minor transgressors, he said, shouldn't necessarily lose their jobs. If they apologize, you know, there's always room for forgiveness. Now, his comments were reasonable, measured. I agreed with them. But for the next few days, nearly 30,000 Me Tooers signed a petition demanding that Damon be erased from his next film. And Minnie Driver, who is his former co-star, she accused him of, quote, being systematically part of the problem. And she told The Guardian, there is no hierarchy of abuse. It's all effing wrong. The time right now is for men to just listen. And the actress and Me Too leader, Alyssa Milano, was also horrified by what Damon said, by his inability to see that silencing women, harassing, grabbing, raping, they're all points on what she called the sexual assault spectrum. And she tweeted in large type, there are different stages of cancer. Some are more treatable than others, but it's still cancer. And like 22,000 people liked that, you know, thought that was great and liked it. Damon then quickly, like, apologized and said, it's just time for me to keep quiet and listen. Well, just a few comments before I move on. Ms. Driver's claim that there's no hierarchy of abuse is completely incoherent. Gradations of harm and degrees of guilt, these are fundamental to our legal system, to our moral intuitions. Our criminal laws make fine distinctions between bad and worse behavior, bad and worse actions, and so do our judgments of one another in everyday life. And also telling all men as a species to shut up and listen, that's not progress, that's bullying. And I can't help but comment on Alyssa Milano's cancer metaphor. She seems not to realize that it supports what Damon is saying, because all cancers are not the same, right? Stage 4 pancreatic cancer does not get the same treatment as stage 1, you know, basal cell skin cancer. Thank goodness she's not an oncologist. Look, the Me Too movement has the potential to correct too many long-tolerated abuses, and it can lead to a new era, a new understanding between men and women. And I want it to succeed, but if it's going to succeed, the movement is going to have to channel the outrage and control its own excesses. One final example, the Women's March. The Women's March, it looked like it was going to reinvigorate the women's movement. It attracted women initially from all walks of life, different religions, backgrounds, ethnicities. There was political diversity. There were some conservative women there, moderates, liberals, radicals, all signed up. And then the excommunications began. Some prominent feminist writers, whose names we will go unmentioned, actually it was Jessica Valente and Roxane Gay, they discovered that pro-life women's groups were on the list of march sponsors. And they expressed outrage and they demanded these women be dropped, these groups be dropped. And their names were quietly dropped from the list. Then more controversy ensued. It has now come out that at early planning meetings, two leaders, Carmen Perez and Tamika Mallory, they were at an early planning meeting and they were doing, we'll talk about it in a minute, but advanced intersectional practice. So it was sort of a progressive, the people who got to talk and be leaders had to be the ones that had the most oppression points. And there was a Jewish woman there who was going to be on the board. Then they started questioning her about her being, you know, her white privilege as a Jew. And one of them chastised her for the role that the Jews played in the slave trade. Now, this is a kind of shocking thing. This is an anti-Semitic lie, but it's a favorite of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. And Louis Farrakhan is notorious for saying things like, it's the wicked Jews, the false Jews, that are promoting lesbianism and homosexuality. Well, this past December, a newspaper, or actually an online site called Tablet, as well as the New York Times, reported on just all this anti-Semitism in the leadership of the Women's March. And close ties between Carmen Perez and Tamika Mallory with the Nation of Islam. They'd hired the Nation of Islam for security. Tamika had, you know, posted pictures of herself next to Farrakhan, you know, calling him the greatest of all time, the GOAT, on and on. So what happens? Groups, the Democratic National Committee doesn't want to be a sponsor anymore. They lose the NAACP. They lost Emily's List. Sponsors defected in droves. And then a truly fatal controversy erupted. Trans activists call the pussy hats transphobic. Well, the march is now in a sort of death spiral roller coaster. So, what's going on? Why do professors, one of them leading a program in editing. Why do they feel free to go in the New York Times and go on this anti-male rant? Why do they do it? Why do they think it's a good thing? What the hell's going on with that? What explains the forced apology of Matt Damon and the meltdown of the Women's March? There's a kind of madness that has found its way into the heart of the contemporary women's movement. But to understand how it got there, we need to consult the historical record, or herstorical, as I prefer to say it. So just a tiny bit of herstory, and then we'll try to figure it all out. The seeds of dysfunction were laid down many years ago. I know because I was there. I saw it happen. Way back in 1986, I spent a summer immersed in the emerging literature known as feminist theory. The chair of my department asked me if I wanted to develop a course on it. And I thought, well, I'm a feminist, I'm a theorist. Okay, I'll read the books and the articles. I sent away, they came in. Let me preface my remarks by saying to you that I have always been a strong supporter of classical equity feminism. Now, equity feminism is rooted in the liberal democratic tradition that comes to us from the European Enlightenment. It wants for women what it wants for everyone: fair treatment, liberty, dignity, opportunity. And the great equity feminist theorists and reformers include people like Mary Wollstonecraft in the 18th century, John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor in the 19th, and then the suffragists like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Sojourner Truth. They advanced the cause of women in ways which are immeasurable, effective, concrete. And because of what they did, we earned, you know, the right to vote. Women got the right to vote and many, many other freedoms. And they did it through appeals to reason and appeals to shared humanity. And today, women in the U.S. and throughout the rest and other parts of the world just take for granted things like the right to vote, to be educated on a par with men, to enter marriage as an equal, to be free and a self-determining human being. And Rahaf al-Khanan, the Saudi Arabian woman who fled her abusive family, she reminds us that the freedoms we take for granted are precious. And she risked her life to claim them. But back in the summer of 1986, I encountered for the first time the ideas of several prominent feminist thinkers who clearly did not think that the achievements of equality feminism, equity feminism, they didn't think they were worth risking your life for. In fact, they viewed the entire liberal democratic tradition as a sort of calamity for women. The first book I read was called Feminist Politics and Human Nature, and it was by a feminist philosopher, Alison Jagger, and she characterizes the plight of women all over the world in this way, including the United States. Quote, women represent half the global population, but they receive 1/10 of the world's income, own less than 1% of the world's property, yet are responsible for 2/3 of all the working hours. She describes this colossal global system of oppression, as I said, includes the United States. And she thinks liberal feminism is not only implicated, but it can't possibly cope with overthrowing this colossus, this massive patriarchy. So what she endorses is a hybrid of radical feminism and Marxist-Leninism. She calls it socialist feminism. And she doesn't like Marxism because it's too sexist, and she doesn't like radical feminism because it's too, they tend to be pacifists. So she says socialist feminists, quote, are sufficiently Marxist to be skeptical that the white male ruling class would give up its power without a violent struggle. However, socialist feminists are confident that that such a struggle would be won. Now, I'm reading this as a feminist, but I'm thinking, a violent struggle, bring down capitalism? What is she talking about? It seemed excessive. And what was she going to replace it with? She was very vague about that. She was also vague about her sources. Like this claim to, that, you know, women do all 2/3 of the work, but they get nothing in return, and you know, you hear this all the time, this claim about women doing all the work but only owning 1% of the property. That fictoid has been around since the 1970s. It's been on banners. It's in, you know, feminist fact lists. Fictoid lists is what they should be called. It's everywhere. And so I checked her footnotes. She footnotes, and this is a very academic, scholarly book. Where did she get that claim? And claims like that obviously, inspire her to look for dramatic solutions. And she got it from Ms. Magazine. I went to Ms. Magazine. They referred to some vague source at the UN. I went to the UN. Long story short, I couldn't even get to the bottom of it. It's now a well-known urban legend. Someone just made it up, and it got into the sort of feminist echo chamber and has stayed there. It's still there. You'll still hear it. Her book is still in print, keeps coming out in a nice new prints, and it's never been corrected. But by the way, it's been debunked many times, but most recently by a Maryland professor, Philip Cohen, in the Atlantic in 2013. But anyway, so her book, she wants violence and she wants to take down the patriarchy. I kind of couldn't relate to that. So next I took up a book by Bell Hooks, Feminist Theory from Margin to Center. And I was happy with that book to begin with. She made a lot of good points. How African-American women had been marginalized in the mainstream women's movement. I liked the way she was passionate about lifting women up. But she wasn't antagonistic about men. She seemed good-hearted and compassionate, and I was just delighted to find a contemporary feminist theorist that I could relate to. However, as I read on in the book, before long, she too was denouncing equity feminism and liberal democracy, and she was calling for a takedown of the capitalist patriarchy. This is a quote she said, to highlight the inadequacies of equity feminism. Oh, no, that's me. To highlight the excesses of equity feminism, she gives the example of Sandra Day O'Connor, who was the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court. Now, most women, equity feminists, think, well, that's a milestone. You know, we got a woman in the Supreme Court. Now you get more and more. It's progress. Nope, says Ms. Hooks, Professor Hooks. She said, women like Connor will exercise power alongside men even as they continue to support white supremacy, capitalism, and patriarchy. So again, this is very radical. Her idea is that we must, you know, transform every burn it all down and rebuild a utopian society. Just as an aside, I should tell you that I recently read an analysis by the British philosopher Roger Scruton about why so many humanities professors seem to be attracted to these wild utopian schemes. American constitutional democracy is not perfect, but it's pretty good. And what are they comparing it to? What are they offering in its place? And what I find is they seem to make the perfect the enemy of the good. But anyway, Roger Scruton suggested that in the academy attracts people, the left-wingers in the academy, they're attracted to, what he said is they have scorn for the imperfect and the normal and the ordinary. They have an unusual just antipathy towards anything ordinary. Radicalism, he said, is, quote, a cry against the actual on behalf of the unknowable. Well, that was certainly going on in these books. They did not like American society. I looked around, even in the 80s, it looked like we were making progress. I was a college professor. I would look in my classrooms. I saw all of these young women, ambitious, and going into law school and business school, and yet it worried me that they would be reading these texts and hearing these grim theories about how they were trapped in a global patriarchy. However, it turned out that Jagger and Hooks were relatively restrained compared to one other theorist that I read that summer, the legal scholar, the feminist legal theorist, Catherine MacKinnon. Catherine MacKinnon said that male dominance is perhaps the most pervasive and tenacious system of power in history. She calls it metaphysically near perfect. So perfect that the people trapped in it don't even know it. It is so powerful, it's nearly invisible. And most women, she says, don't realize that they live in sexual objectification the way a fish lives in water. Everything about us, our identities, our sense of ourselves, our aspirations, our desires, they were all shaped by a hostile force outside ourselves. Language, every institution bears the impress of this patriarchal oppressive force, the most tenacious and pervasive system of corrupt power in history. Now, she sees a little chance of salvation if women can just get away for a, you know, just furtively get away somewhere and talk to each other and share their experiences, which will, you know, in consciousness raising, it'll be like all the horrible things that have happened to them. They'll tell stories about it, about how they've been violated. And then she thinks there would be, you know, a new awareness that they can begin to organize and push back. But it's, you know, fraught with danger because we've internalized our own oppressor. So there are many ways in which we can pull ourselves back and not realize what's going on. And she has some statistical claims too, that half of American women have been raped, she says, a third battered, and a fifth have been or were prostitutes, and most cannot get out of it. No, she says one-fifth have been or are known to be prostitutes, whatever that means, and cannot get out of it. Now, if she was right, the United States would be more dangerous than any place on earth, more than a war-torn Somalia. Where did her figures come from? Well, she cites page after page of articles by scholar activists who share her worldview. You won't find, you know, say the Bureau of Justice study, you know, annual survey of crime, which just sets the gold standard for research on crime. You know, if this was happening, and we might have picked it up in some objective, but she found it and she believes it. And so I became concerned that it just seemed to me that feminism had been hijacked by eccentrics with no accountability to reality. They had their own facts. And I wrote a book. It took me a few years, but in 1994, I published a book called Who Stole Feminism? I pushed back on the Jagger, Hooks, MacKinnon worldview. I tried to show that they were promoting anti-democratic ideas. Their books were just hostile to things like free speech and due process. They were giving a generation of young women a distorted picture of our society. And I insisted in the book that equity feminism was working. So my book was not just criticizing them, but it was a tribute to equality feminism, the tradition, the classical liberal tradition. And as they say, you know, it's attributed to Churchill, but I don't think he said it, you know, democracy is the worst form of government except for all the rest. And that's what I'll say about equity feminism. It's the worst form of feminism, except for all the rest. And I don't even want to know where, you know, Jagger would take us or Catherine MacKinnon. Well, actually, we're going to find out where Catherine MacKinnon took us. Some prominent feminists agreed with what I had to say, and I received a little bit of fan mail from my colleagues, but less than I hoped for. For the most part, the feminist establishment was put out with me for my book. Many scholars were convinced that the United States is an oppressive patriarchy. They did not appreciate my plea for moderation. And I was subject to a colorful number of attacks for my heresy. Some called me a backlasher, a traitor to my gender, anti-woman. On one occasion, I was even called a non-woman. One angry critic resorted to a gender-based attack. She referred to former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Christina Hoff Sommers, those two female impersonators. Now, by the way, somebody recently called me a female impersonator on Tumblr, and they were called out by dozens of social justice activists for using the word female impersonator. You're not supposed to do that. And there was something strangely validating about that. Anyway, over the years, other feminist scholars, lawyers, writers, so many of them, they joined me in pointing out the excesses of radical feminist theories, the dangers. People like Nadine Strossen, the former president of the ACLU, and brilliant scholars like Katie Roifey and Daphne Patai and Coretta Kortka. They were, are UMass, well, you know, Coretta Kortka is a scientist at the University of Indiana, and she and Daphne Patai, who's at the University of Massachusetts in, I think, English department, they wrote a book exposing the excesses and the madness. It's called, Professing Feminism, The Strange World of Women's Studies. And they went in and found that things were weird. Anyway, there were a group of us, Wendy Kaminer, and of course, I even had a goddess on my side, Camille Paglia, a brilliant dissident libertarian feminist, and her last name is Paglia, P-A-G-L-I-A, Camille Paglia. Check out her lectures on YouTube, no matter what you do. She's fantastic. She was a free spirit, and we just thought, okay. And we wrote a lot of articles. We had books, and we thought we won. The media was mostly on our side back then in the early 90s, mid-90s. And I guess our idea was that the eccentric, illiberal theories and the crazy statistics, they would just fall by the weight of their own insanity. It didn't happen. The hardliners may be statistically challenged and prone to conspiracy theories, but they proved to be brilliant when it came to building a power base in the academy. And it didn't matter if their scholarship was full of mistakes and, you know, bizarre assertions, because critics could be dismissed as apologists for the capitalist patriarchy. So who'd want to do that? Who'd want to get accused? You know, so you know what happened? Most scholars, many who even, you know, feminist scholars in the academy just ignored it, didn't want to get involved. I don't blame them. I don't think I would have gotten involved if I'd known what I was getting involved with, but I did. They didn't get involved, and most men just ran for cover. I'm talking about scholars, you know, professors in the academy. So today, the Jagger, McKinnon, Hooks vision, it's actually more powerful than ever. It just stayed there. It got tenure. It assumed, you know, all the assistant professorships, and now we have a critical mass of people in the university who, as I said, reject equity feminism, they reject liberal democracy in favor of whatever alternative they're presenting. So now what's happened is that the Jagger, McKinnon, Hooks vision is more powerful than ever, as I said, because it's merged with intersectionality. And at the highly privileged intersections of American education, higher education, intersectionality is now all the rage. And the classical liberal tradition, with its emphasis on reason, free expression, due process, rule of law, that's all under a cloud. Now, let me talk about intersectionality, because it begins with a genuine insight. And in the 1989 Law Review, a UCLA professor, a young professor, Kimberly Crenshaw, she wrote a very interesting article showing how racism and sexism in isolation could render Black women invisible. Because of their complex social identities, Black women, she showed, were vulnerable to a unique set of injustices and indignities. And she said we need to pay attention to people at the intersections, and thus the term intersectionality. Now today, under that rubric, intersectionality, you find, you know, a growing scholarship, and some of it's reasonable. I don't reject all of it. If the closer it stays to, you know, just analyzing people's complex identities and showing how, you know, people have different fates and our institutions affect them differently depending on these identities, that's all fine. But I will tell you that, I don't know where this field is going, but there are hundreds and hundreds, just it's growing exponentially, all of this intersectional scholarship. And there are huge arguments, disagreements. Nobody can agree on what it is. Nobody agrees on its history. People fight, you know, all over. It's got like very bad politics, which isn't unusual for any academic field. So that's all fine. It's not new. But here is what is new. A very extreme, untested, completely random version of this theory has been fast-tracked into the undergraduate curriculum. So while academics are admitting they don't know what it is, and they're writing papers, and they're trying to figure it all out, someone decides that they figured it all out and are putting it in textbooks. And entire women's studies departments now say that they are dedicated to this radical version of intersectionality. It's taught in college courses, it's promoted on social media, and it's really just the Alison Jagger, Catherine McKinnon, bell hooks, illiberal, you know, conspiracy theory all over again. It can't be falsified because if you criticize it, you're just part of the problem it's trying to solve. And today, a growing number of undergraduate women believe that, depending on their identities, they are oppressed, and not only by sexism, but by racism, classism, ableism, lookism, sizeism, cisgenderism. It goes on and on. There's just a, you know, proliferating isms. It didn't prove, like, stable. There are many axes on which you can be oppressed. But there tends to be one oppressor. I'm looking at quite a few out here in the audience. The white male does not come off well in this drama. There's a textbook which I find very interesting. It's called Race, Class, and Gender. And it's a best-selling college textbook. It's in its 9th edition. And it's co-authored by Patricia Collins, and she's one of the architects of radical intersectionality. The textbook describes the United States as a matrix of domination. Beneath a veneer of freedom and opportunity, there lies a rigid system of privilege and domination. And according to this textbook, so, you know, freshmen read this book, they learn, oh, okay, I live in a matrix of domination. Able-bodied straight white men garner most of the privilege. Everyone else bears the burdens, some more than others, depending on their identities. Now, students who use this book learn that this white male elite, they sort of carry around a knapsack of unearned, undeserved assets, all sorts of special little tools, maps, blank checks that nobody else gets. And these assets give them power over other groups, including the power to make their domination seem reasonable and just. Myths, these elites spin myths like meritocracy or democratic choice, which help them maintain their dominion. And as the text explains, much of what we call knowledge has been constructed largely from the experience of these white male elites. However, just like Catherine McKinnon said there was a way out for women of this invisible nightmare, Collins and her co-author explain that there is cause for hope. This system may have made the dominant white males powerful, but it did not make them wise. Marginalized groups such as women, people of color, LGBT people, the poor, the disabled, they have access, because of their marginalization, they have privileged access to deeper, more liberating knowledge about human reality. They have deeper knowledge, more wisdom than their oppressors. So the pursuit of this hidden, this deep knowledge, subjugated knowledge, she gets that from Michel Foucault, this subjugated knowledge, it's hard to get to it, and it's fraught with risk, because she also says most of us have already internalized our oppressor. God, this stuff is just so crazy. I don't know how it got so far, but anyway, we've internalized our oppressor, and we tend to recite the dominant narrative, but to overcome this, to outsmart your internal oppressor, marginalized people. That includes women, and it includes everybody except able-bodied straight white men. They require a safe space where they can speak openly about their lived experience. So the mission of radical, and remember, I'm talking about radical intersectionality. I'm not talking about other versions that are debated and you know, that started with Kimberlé Crenshaw. I'm talking about how it's now practiced on many campuses, taught in intro courses, and it's in the textbooks. And it, to me, looks like, again, a sort of paranoid conspiracy theory where they have a clear Manichaean view of good and evil and a common enemy, which is sort of dangerous. Common enemy politics have a bad history, but we'll get to that in a minute. So the mission of radical intersectionality is to, in any way you can, destabilize the matrix of oppression and eventually replace it with a just and fair society free of systemic oppression. But for that to happen, members of privileged groups have to, men, white, able-bodied, straight men mainly, they just have to keep quiet. Don't try to defend themselves with language, with logic and reason. Be allies. So, let me just state a few of my concerns about this. And I'll start with my minor worries and then my major worry, and then I'll try to wrap up so we can talk about this. We're told that marginalized people, we should listen to marginalized people and be their ally. But right away, if you look at this claim carefully, not all marginalized people agree with one another. I mean, they don't think alike. Take a friend of mine, the writer Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She's a woman of color, she's an immigrant. She doesn't see the US as a matrix of oppression. Her lived experience tells her that it's a matrix of freedom and happiness and opportunity. Someone's lived experience, I agree, it tells us something. And there are all sorts of reasons why you want to hear people's stories. But if you're going to generalize and have a social movement or a policy, a law, you're going to have to find out whether or not that person's account is representative. Is it the experience of others in their group? You know, you eventually have to decide whose story is more reliable and reasonable. In this race, class, gender textbook, students learn that industrial capitalism is a, quote, white male project. It speaks of white male coalition that protect their wages. This coalition protects its wages from competition from women and men from subordinate groups. I hear that, and then I just can't help but notice some facts that belie the theory. Like, if this were true, you'd think that, you know, this patriarchy is so powerful, and they can do a good job protecting their own. The highest earners in the U.S. are Asian males. In fact, the earnings gap between Asian males and white males is larger than the gap between men and women. Now, it seems to be an assumption of this theory that when anybody has an advantage, it's, you know, because of some evil thing they did or some benefit they accrued they didn't deserve. Now, is it, I don't know. I mean, maybe they have an answer to this, but is it different? I guess my question is, do Asian men need to check their privilege? In the intersectional universe, straight men are said to benefit from unearned privilege in the workplace at the expense of gay men. And straight women enjoy undeserved advantages to the detriment of their lesbian sisters. But two Vanderbilt University economists, Christopher Carpenter and Samuel Epink, looked at the data, and it turns out that gay men now out-earn straight men, and lesbians out-earn straight women. And is that because of their unearned privilege? I mean, shouldn't we at least be able to sort of explore, well, why is that? What are they doing? And maybe we could learn from it. Maybe we could have a good policy about, you know, find out why are some groups succeeding. But not just assume, first of all, falsely, that it's the white male elite that control the capitalist monster and so forth. Education beyond high school, it's considered the new passport to the American dream. Increasingly, women have it and men do not. Women are leaving men in the dust when it comes to education. You wouldn't predict that from intersectionality, but you'll say, well, which women, the privileged women? Well, actually, if you look at the data, last few years, Department of Education statistics show that Hispanic young women, the rate of college attendance for Hispanic young women is higher than that of white young males attending college. Hispanic women have moved ahead in terms of college matriculation. Young black women are way ahead of their male counterparts, but they are just 1 point behind white males and probably going to surpass them. Asian women are ahead of everybody, but Asian males, anyway, I could go on. I'll do one more, life expectancy. Hispanic and Asian women have the greatest life expectancy. White and black males have the lowest. Now, I bring this up because earnings, education, life expectancy, these are fundamental metrics of well-being. But the United States, it just turns out that it's a complicated, you can't oversimplify it. It's complicated. But yet we see these sweeping claims about white male privilege. Now, I am not denying that there is, I'm not using these statistics to suggest we don't have sexism and racism and so forth. Of course we do. But we're making progress. And you can't automatically attribute every, like between men and women, I think it's ridiculous to attribute every disparity to discrimination. There may be other explanations. I mean, one of the reasons that Asians earn more is they tend to major in science and math more in college. That predicts earning more. And men tend to major in science and math more than women. That predicts earning more. So maybe the same reasons, it's not discrimination, it's the choices people make. And, you know, we can go on with that. But it just, here's my most serious objection to radical intersectionality. You can't fight sexism and racism by rigidly organizing everyone by race and sex. You have to treat everybody as individuals. And in their recent book, Coddling of the American Mind, the authors Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff made a critical distinction between common humanity versus common enemy, identity politics. And they say Martin Luther King practiced common humanity. He didn't demonize or shame those he was opposing. He humanized his opponents and then made appeals based on shared humanity and universal rights. Common enemy politics, on the other hand, builds solidarity through anger and a despised enemy. So radical intersectionality, it is common enemy politics, and it has occupied feminism. Just go back quickly to our three examples that I gave at the beginning. Those two professors, think about their mindset. They do view men as a despised enemy, and they feel perfectly free to trash them. Well, I'm sorry, that's not progress. It's brutality. Matt Damon, he made a reasonable argument, but he's a member of a group that has historically oppressed women, so he has to listen to the irrational outbursts of Minnie Driver and Alyssa Milano and then apologize and be their ally and just keep quiet. That's not feminism. That's a nightmare. Now look at the Women's March. Common enemy intersectionality is turning it into a matrix of misery. Well, it doesn't have to be this way. As an age-enhanced Jewish female with a gender nonconforming multi-poo named Izzy, my lived experience, I wanted to bring her, but when I was at Oberlin, a bunch of students ran off to a safe space with a dog. They had a therapy dog. I guess I triggered that dog for just saying the things I'm saying tonight. But anyway, I didn't want Izzy to be hauled off to some safe space. It doesn't have to be this way. As an age-enhanced person of gender, I would say that, I'm going to save my recommendations for the end. I would just say that if we had a women's movement that was inclusive, that was built on truth, liberal, fundamental liberal values that have made us and many countries in the world so successful and free, it would be a force for good. We could solve real problems. But for the moment, intersectionality is in ascendance. So I hope your generation finds a way to correct it, because you are positioned to write the next great chapter in the story of human freedom. So I hope it has a happy ending. Anyway, I want to thank you for being such an attentive audience. I would applaud you, but I don't want to cause panic. Thank you. You can applaud if you want. Occasionally there have been questions.
Okay, we're going to be doing a Q&A session now. If you'd please line up at the back here, we'll wave you forward. If you have a question, you'll come forward and get one question. No follow-ups, please.
No follow-ups?
Unless you'd like them, ma'am.
No.
Hi, how do you feel transgenderism is affecting women today, and especially in athletics and stuff like that?
Oh boy, it all happened so fast. And now, I read the, actually it was, I send away for these textbooks, and now I have to stop reading them because it's not good for my health. Intersectionality is already gone. It's all the trans issue. And there's this latest book that I read was, a man who was furious, I don't know what I can say, but it was a woman that this person had a baby, and was furious that the person assumed that she was the mother. Now, I don't know what to say, because I'll get in trouble, but what is this that we can't say that women have babies? But apparently it's that way. Now, I say this to someone, and I told you again, I'm a Southern California free spirit. I totally accept someone being trans, and the person I admire most in the world is an economist, Deirdre McCloskey, who's a libertarian economist, but Deirdre used to be Donald, and she doesn't care if she's dead named or whatever that's called. And she's fantastic, and she's accepted, and people understand. So, and I don't think there's any society as kind of, humane and just nice people are willing to give people a chance. But this isn't just about asking us to be understanding and be fair. Suddenly there are all these radical transformations and possibly eliminating women's sports. And you see that that has to be sorted out. And what people are now so politically correct that they are afraid to stand up. But fortunately, you're beginning to see, I think in sports is where they'll push back, but it's becoming, and by the way, I also have a large Twitter following, and I have trans people who follow me and talk to me and teach me things, and they're not happy with this either. So again, one thing I said is that you have to make sure that the marginalized people, they all agree with this. Who gets to be the spokesman of the trans movement? I would rather have it, well, Deirdre doesn't want to be the spokesman, but I don't know, the people that follow me and that we get along. I would rather they be the spokesman. I don't know how that works, how you get to take it upon yourself to be the spokesman for a marginalized identity. But right now, I think they need a new change. I think they need a change in leadership.
What are your thoughts on the concept of toxic masculinity, especially given the recent and tasteful Gillette commercial, the best a soy boy can get?
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan of that Gillette commercial. And there's just so much of that, just anti-male propaganda. And it hurts me because I wrote a book about boys, and I think most men, grown men, young men just hear this crap and whatever. But little boys are getting this very negative message about who they are. And they're trying to pretend that normal maleness is a pathology or a disorder in need of a cure. And they're making a fundamental mistake, which is that there are you know, men who are sort of pathologically masculine, boys who exhibit pathological masculinity. They show their maleness by hurting people, weaker people, and destroying things. But they're such a minority, a tiny percentage. The vast majority of men evince healthy masculinity, and they protect people, and they build, they don't destroy, and they channel their male exuberance and energy and risk-taking into constructive pursuits. And how did we lose sight of that? And so what we're doing is we're taking a small percentage of monsters and assuming that they are exemplars of the male sex, and then trying to, you know, teach little boys to educate them away from their boyness. Fortunately, the boys aren't cooperating, but it makes them, it's very confusing. So I don't like the idea of toxic masculinity, but if we are going to talk about toxic masculinity, then I think we have to talk about toxic femininity, because that exists too. There are sort of pathological, well, maybe pathological feminism, I should say, that I talked about tonight. I do think this is reckless and irresponsible, this radical thinking and the carelessness with facts, trying to implicate the average man in social atrocity, and then using all this as an excuse to ride roughshod over people's basic rights. And it's just a feminism I don't recognize. Feminism is supposed to be about liberation and happiness and fairness, equality with men. And now it's many quarters becoming authoritarian and accusative and out to destroy men. So I do not favor the term toxic masculinity. Thank you.
So you talked about how equity feminism originally made progress through reason and through a shared humanity that's clearly lacking in modern feminism. So how do we reintroduce that, especially when the education system tends to be dominated by more extreme liberal thought?
Yeah, it's in terms of what to do, what I would say is that right now, sort of common sense and humanism, it doesn't really have a lobby. So you've got a lot of extreme feminists and radical, hardline, aggressive intersectionality practitioners and all those who've kind of taken the microphone and speaking for, you know, even when I was at Lewis and Clark University and those crazy people came and called me all those names and wouldn't let me speak, the majority of students, they were all progressive or liberal. I mean, at that school, there were a few Federalist students who invited me, But a young man came up and apologized, and he was in Black Lives Matter. He said, I'm in Black Lives Matter, but I'm horrified at what they did. So I don't think that the majority of kids, including progressives, including radical feminists, I don't think they like the shaming culture, the call-out culture, this deranged politics of destruction that we see. But I think we're going to, you know, that common sense and basic decency is going to have to form a lobby. And one way to do it is to support YAF. It's sort of keeping common sense and free expression of ideas alive on campus. There are other groups like the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, check that out. As well as, I like Quillette, Quillette. It's just a website with fabulous articles. Reason Magazine, it's more libertarian, but they've got great writers, you know, who are monitoring all of this and saying sensible things. And you could listen to the Femsplainers. My friend and I, Danielle, I also have The Factual Feminist, where I have about 62 videos where I correct a feminist myth in 5 or 6 minutes. You can, if you have a friend that's like too carried away with these false statistics, maybe tell them to take a crash course with The Factual Feminist. But what to do? You know, it's hard, but I think it was Susan B. Anthony said, failure is impossible. Our side can't lose because it's impossible that the other side wins. Thank you.
Hi. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on the practice of the screen being put up at auditions for classical music orchestras, because since that practice has come up, you know, female representation in orchestras has pretty much skyrocketed. But there's still some orchestras like the Vienna Philharmonic who, you know, refuse to do that because, you know, for understandable reasons, they want to see who's auditioning and, you know, their presence and all that stuff. But
yeah,
but you run up against this wall where there's a good argument to actually want to see the person who's auditioning, but the moment that you put a screen up,
yeah,
you know, female representation rises. So
I'm amazed you asked me that because I've been tweeting about it. Yeah, because about 2 weeks ago, I've been hearing about this study for years, and I know that I respect the woman who did it. She's a Harvard economist. And for years, I would cite it in my lectures as, you know, why we still have work to do, because there's still this implicit bias against women, and look at this orchestra study. Look what happened. Well, somebody, a statistician, tweeted out and said, you know, I looked at the study, and it doesn't show what it supposedly showed. In fact, it shows nothing. Nothing happened from this. And I couldn't believe it, because it's iconic. And I thought, so I tweeted, well, ask the author, because I thought, you better ask the author, and then she'll... And the author just wrote back and said, well, it wasn't really... I mean, she just said something that was kind of inconclusive, but agreed that the way it was reported in the press was completely off, you know, off base. So what happened was I don't know. I would think there might be an advantage, but there, you know, you don't know, because that sometimes people, if they don't have enough women, they give women an advantage. So there have been some studies where if you don't know who the author is, do they just get a lot of males? And so it's better to have it open. I think that, you know, may be true in philosophy journals. I'm not sure that I saw a study where it didn't help. So it's a mix. We just don't know. But, you know, here's the thing. I would like to know. And I just wish two things. I wish, I don't fault the person who did the study. Well, I do fault her maybe for not correcting the hype. But that'd be hard to resist, I guess, if you're an author and everybody's talking about your study, even though it didn't do what they say it did. She did this study and showed that when you have blind auditions, you know, it greatly increases the number of women who get selected for the orchestra. And that's just proof that there's all this bias. But it didn't prove that. And I didn't know that till last week. You know, if you'd brought it up, I would have said, yeah, that study. It's just one, you know, there are a lot of studies that are not holding up, just sort of wish fulfillment studies or advocacy research. But we can do well-designed studies. And one of the things I say is that it upsets me when people fudge data or are sloppy when they're studying something like sexual violence or domestic violence or workplace injustice. Women who are in trouble need help. And that means you need the truth if you're going to have solutions. And I'm afraid that this radical style of feminism, which took off in the 80s and never stopped, I think it's actually impeding solutions and keeping us from finding, solving problems. Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Hi, ma'am. Thanks for coming today. Big fan of your YouTube videos, actually. But
my videos, yeah.
You spoke of Asian privilege. Yeah. And quite honestly, as an Indian male myself, I completely agree with you there. I look at myself, I look at other people like me, and I think, man, I'm not oppressed at all. I'm the best person in this country, honestly, because...
You've internalized your oppression.
Yeah. I look at white males, and it just seems like they're so instantly vilified, and they have to be, you know, they have to be culturally accepting, but not too accepting, because then it's appropriation, and then, you know,
right.
There's so many just... things that they have to consider. And so I look at myself, I don't have to deal with any of that. So why do you think Asian privilege is not something that is talked about often? Because we're the most paid, we're the most educated, we're first or second generation.
And it also suggests that American society, despite all sorts of, you know, attitudes in different places, bad attitudes or seem, American society's kind of open and, you know, people can come here and who don't fit the model of it is set up by the white male patriarchal hegemons, and they earn more and get better educated and take it, you know. Why don't we analyze what they did, figure out how we replicate that for other groups? And as I said, it does have to do with a lot to do with educational choices, and it has a lot to do with stable families. I think you see a lot of African American boys and poor white boys, poor African American, poor white boys struggling, and it correlates with a lot of family disintegration and having no fathers. It just counts. And you tend to have a father in Asian families. It's more likely. It may change as they, years go on and everybody gets more Americanized. But for the moment, I don't know, though. This doesn't seem to be happening to Asian families. So for now, it seems to be something that we would embrace as evidence that we're an open society. But I'm glad you speak up, because it is, I think, right now, we have demonized men, and they're like becoming white males are becoming an outcast group that are now a lot of them maybe don't care because they can still just keep their heads down and work hard and study, and it's still there are still advantages, but overall this is no way to make progress. It's just a way to create feuding tribes. There's no history that they can point to where denigrating one group and treating them as the enemy, that led to progress. It leads to misery and sometimes often violence. But anyway, I appreciate what you say. Yeah.
Okay. So, on the topic of false accusations, mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of accounts of men, being hesitant to really meet with women one-on-one, even in the professional setting. They don't want to have individual meetings with their female coworkers, or on a college campus, they might be afraid of the hookup culture. Do you feel like that's a justified fear?
Yeah, now it is, because you never know who you're dealing with, but what I would say is there's no question that there's a problem on campus where you do have some criminal predators. It's the exception, but it happens. Everybody has to be careful. Young women have to be careful. But they've used fake studies and manipulated, to make it look like it's an epidemic, and that women are, these studies, as I said, if they were true, it would mean that we have on campus, and the more elite the campus, if it's Swarthmore, it's like everybody is a victim of male toxic male violence. These males, at this school are just so beaten down, and they're not allowed to do anything. They're not doing anything. But it's like a kind of contagion of hysteria. And what upsets me most is these women will, I've seen these cases. They're now, the boys are finally suing the school, but young men will be accused when anybody would look at what happened. Even the young woman will say, this is what happened, and it doesn't look like anything close to sexual assault. But she felt like, there was a case at University of Massachusetts where she just felt afterwards that it hadn't really been her choice, and although technically wasn't rape, it felt like she was violated in some ways. And so she made this case against him, and it ruined his life. He was this immigrant. He was a son of immigrants from Ghana. He was studying electrical engineering. He had this great future. He had to drop out. He couldn't get into other schools. He was marked. In the end, they found him innocent. They found him not guilty, because there were no charges that made sense to anybody. But he had reached out to friends for help, and that's against the rules. When you're accused, you enter Kafka's The Trial. You're not allowed to talk to anybody. You're not allowed to find out. It's a nightmare. What kind of feminist would set up an institution where you subject your fellow, friends and brothers to a nightmare? And you can try to have better systems for protecting young women, because that's a nightmare too. But the answer is not to create more injustice. That's just not the answer. But the mindset that comes from that tradition of seeing men and women, they're playing at a, they're we're on team feminism and they're on, you know, team toxic masculinity. You show no mercy for team toxic masculinity. And that's every man. And I'm frightened that you'd be women that can have such cold hearts and indifferent to ruining someone's life. But it's going on. So thank you.
First of all, I'm really honored to hear you speak in person. It's really refreshing that you're pushing back on a lot of this stuff because it's real, it exists, I've encountered it in my life. So thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you.
I'm a bit older than most of the people on this campus, so, you know,
everybody looks perhaps, like a kid to me.
Perhaps, you know, perhaps I'm not the audience that really needs to hear the things you're saying the most. But forgive me, I just found out about you when I saw flyers for this talk. So if you've addressed these questions in your book, I'm going to try to sneak two in if I can. If you've addressed these questions in your books or in interviews, please forgive me. Mm-hmm. But what would you say to people who may criticize you of sort of sinking to the people's level of the people that you're criticizing, you know, that you're more concerned about like sort of mudslinging than addressing the specific issues that women mm-hmm. face? And the second question would be, I really don't approve of the sort of oppression Olympics form of intersectionality, mm-hmm. as Ben Shapiro calls it, but it seems like the premise is sound, you know, like a single black woman in Mississippi has different challenges than a married Latina woman in Texas. So do you see like a way out of the weeds? Because you expressed confidence that this sort of stuff would go away in the 70s or 80s or whatever you
yeah,
said.
Yeah, I thought it would go away. I thought logic and reason, you know, would defeat it, but that we're going to need more, a bigger boat, as they say. So your first question, yeah, I know. Someone once said to me, well, you're very critical of these hardline feminists, and you think they're very negative and, you know, but you're very critical of them, and you're very negative. And I said, it's all right to be critical and negative if you're right, you know? And if you have evidence to back it up. I would like to come here and be positive. Let's try to... And I go through moods where I think, okay, maybe I'm overreacting. Maybe I'm not being fair. I'm going to go back and read this and take off all my confirmation bias. And I'm really going to try to feel like I'm oppressed by the patriarchy and kind of understand what they think. And I can't get there. I try. I don't understand. I don't want to sling mud, and I don't hate them. I meet them. I'm you know, once in a while we talk, and it's fine. But I don't understand them, and that something is badly wrong, and I'm just going to keep speaking out. The good news is that now with social media, there are more and more people joining me. Before it was like a little group of us, and we'd write op-eds. But now, because of social media, because of Quillette, because people like Dave Rubin, Joe Rogan, the intellectual dark web, we're called. We just challenge the status quo, and we're not welcome with these views. Even though most of us are mainstream classical liberals, you're not welcome. So, I know I should, I am very critical, but I think I back it up. And if I don't, I'll change my mind. You had a second question, which was about, you mentioned about identities. Well, here's another fallacy in intersectionality. Where's the end point? I think the end point, there are, multiple axes of, identities in all of us. And where do you stop? Why not? Okay, when you get to the end, you'll have the individual. So let's just start there. And I'm not sure, a lot of the women that are writing these theories, they may be women of color, but they're very privileged, They're they have PhDs. So they don't have maybe the right to be interpreting the lives of women with less than them. So where does that go? And then you can, and there are a lot of males that I think should get more consideration if we're going to have a victim Olympics, because we do have males with the autism or on the Asperger, the autism spectrum. Why aren't they included? people with mental health issues, people with depression. Everybody has something. So probably in the end, we should just kind of like be nice to each other, a presumption of decency, and get together and solve the big problems that are, you know, that are clearly vexing the society. And that's happened in a way. I mean, conservatives and liberals are getting together to address the horror of our prison system. I would put that high on the list of an issue that has intersectional issues, but all kinds of problems. We could do that. But to get there, we're going to have to go through this, I don't know, these activists and these professors, and this information is being taught, the textbook that I talk about. And I worry that we may have lost the argument. But I'm not going to give up. Because some of you out there will become activists and troublemakers and, you know, make it a challenge and say that the emperor has no clothes, or in this case, the empress is threadbare. That's what I would say about contemporary feminism. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Jazz hands.